Well, thanks very much for that nice introduction, Kendrick, and thanks for the opportunity to be here. It's always great to be back in Canada. Despite the snow, it's nice, nice break from Dallas. All right, so I'm going to talk to you today about what we can learn from CMB science. So the cosmic microwave background has completely transformed our understanding of the history, contents, and evolution of the universe. And what I'll try to convince you of today is that there's much more to learn from upcoming observations of the CMB, but there are also some challenges that we have to surmount to make the most of those upcoming observations. So as cosmologists, we pride ourselves on the fact that we can understand 13.8 billion years of cosmic history. And that's true, and it is impressive, but it's slightly less impressive when phrased in terms of energy scale or expansion history. There's actually a big chunk of the early universe that we don't have direct access to. In particular, we can observe galaxies at low redshift, and we can observe the CMB at the surface of last scattering or recombination, which happened about 380,000 years after the onset of hot Big Bang evolution. And we get a lot of great direct information from this epoch, but we don't have much direct information from the earlier periods, the much higher energies, and that's where a lot of secrets about high energy physics, fundamental physics, may lurk, things like the nature of dark matter, fundamental physics beyond the standard model. However, I'll argue in this talk that the next generation of CMB observations will actually allow us to push into this regime in a much in a characteristically different way than we've been able to do up to this point. And furthermore, even though with CMB observations we're really observing things at this one screen at recombination, we also have imprints of the structure that intervenes between us and that surface of last scattering. And one big theme of this talk is those imprints of structure are both a blessing and a curse for our observations of the CMB and what we can learn from upcoming observations. All right, so with that motivation, here's a quick outline. So I'll give a very quick overview of CMB science. I'll then focus on gravitational lensing of the CMB as one of these characteristic examples by which we have new opportunities and new challenges with forthcoming observations. I'll talk about how we can use CMB lensing to measure properties of cosmic neutrinos, and then why we might want to motivate improving our estimates of CMB lensing. I'll talk then about light relics and how delensing can improve our constraints on light relics and other physics. And then if we have time at the end, I'll talk about some other CMB secondaries that we can extract with machine learning. Feel free to stop me along the way. I will not be upset if I don't get to that last topic. It's a little bit ambitious what I've packed into this talk. So feel free to stop me along the way and ask questions. All right, so I'll start with a very quick review of the CMB. I'm going to assume a relative decent level of knowledge for the CMB. So I'll go very quickly through this, but please do stop me if I'm going too fast. So the CMB is the oldest and most distant light that we can observe in the universe. It agrees very well with a nearly perfect black body spectrum, and the fact that it agrees with such a perfect thermal spectrum gives us very strong evidence in favor of the hot Big Bang model of cosmology. This is a stunning success for modern cosmology, but it's not going to be the focus of this talk. Instead, we'll primarily focus on the deviations from uniformity in the CMB. Those deviations from uniformity in the CMB come from sound waves that were propagating in the primordial plasma prior to the epoch of recombination. And those sound waves are seeded by initial density fluctuations that then propagate outward. And this initial plasma was made up of several different distinct fluids. Shown here in this animation, there's dark matter, gas, which is the baryonic matter in the early universe, the photons in red and neutrinos in green. And the basic idea of what's being shown here is that you start with some initial density fluctuation in some specific place, and those perturbations propagate outward as a sound wave from that initial density fluctuation. And each of those fluids behaves a little bit differently. They're all coupled via gravity. The gas and photons remain coupled up until the time of recombination, at which point the photons begin free streaming toward us at the epoch of recombination. And what we see in the CMB is a snapshot of the evolution of this density wave, this sound wave propagating through the plasma at the time of recombination. So specifically in this animation, that occurs when the redshift up in the corner here is at about 1100, or the time's at about 380,000 years. And so you can see the blue and the red decouple around that time. And what we get in the CMB is a snapshot of the universe as it was at that time. All right, and so what we see, of course, is not a single density fluctuation at some place in the sky, but rather a superposition of many, many density fluctuations from this initial spectrum of density fluctuations laid down by whatever preceded the hot Big Bang evolution of the universe, perhaps cosmic inflation or something else. The basic idea is each of those individual sound waves gives that circular pattern that you can see, but you stack up a bunch of those across the whole sky. However, the statistical information that's imprinted by the sound waves that we're propagating through the plasma are still apparent in the final map that you get despite having stacked a bunch of these things at the end of the day. In addition to the density fluctuations, which we observe as temperature anisotropies in the CMB, we also see linear polarization that's imprinted in the cosmic microwave background. This arises due to the fact that quadrupolar anisotropy incoming on free electrons scatters in our line of sight with a preferential direction for the electric field. So specifically, if there's more intense radiation coming from my left and right than from up and than from above and below, that preferentially jiggles free electrons in a vertical plane, and then propagating toward you, you'll see the electric field preferentially aligned vertically. So this Thomson scattering in the presence of quadrupolar anisotropies, which are an absolutely necessary aspect of the way that the recombination took place, predicts linear polarization of the CMB. So that linear polarization defines a spin 2 field across the whole sky, so headless vectors everywhere throughout the sky. And it's most convenient to analyze this linear polarization in terms of so-called E-modes and B-modes. E-modes are these parity even patterns of linear polarization that look the same in the mirror as when you look at them normally. And B-modes are the parity odd components, the things that change their sign, the pattern that changes their sign when you look at it in the mirror. Now, this is a particular convenient split for the linear polarization because density fluctuations produce only E-mode fluctuations, while primordial gravitational waves produce both E-modes and B-modes. And so one of the key targets of upcoming CMB surveys is a search for these primordial B-modes, which would be a smoking gun of primordial gravitational waves predicted, for example, by theories of inflation. Now, most of the statistical information in the CMB is contained in the two-point statistics of these fluctuations of the temperature and polarization fluctuations. And so what we do when we analyze the CMB is we make a map of those anisotropies across the sky. So this is a map of the whole sky in temperature anisotropies from Planck. And what we take is we take the two-point correlation function of these temperature fluctuations and also the polarization fluctuations. And then we take the harmonic transform, and what we get is the thing on the right, which is the angular power spectra of temperature, E-mode polarization, and then B-mode polarization. Now, if you change the physics of the plasma through which these sound waves propagated in the early universe, you change the position and shapes of these bumps and wiggles that appear in this characteristic angular power spectrum. Or turning that around, if we analyze the observations of the positions of these bumps and wiggles, we can infer the contents of the universe through which those density waves were propagating in the early universe. And this procedure has allowed us to solidify the flat lambda CDM model of cosmology with percent level precision on all the parameters that define it, except for one parameter, the optical depth, which has a slightly higher uncertainty. So this all has been a very successful aspect of CMB observations. It has really dramatically changed the way we understand the universe. But what I'm going to argue to you for the rest of this talk is that there's much more to do with the future CMB observations. Of course, we will do all of what I just said, and we will do it better. But if that were all I had to say, that would be kind of a boring talk. So I'm going to focus on the new things that we can do with the next generation of surveys. And just to put in perspective what I mean by the new generation of surveys, here's a timeline of ongoing and upcoming CMB surveys with a focus on ground-based observations. So in this tan color, these are CMB observations taking place from the Atacama Desert in Chile. And then in blue, these are operations from the South Pole. And then down here, you do see some planned and proposed satellite missions as well, along with some balloon missions down here. I'm going to focus for this talk on ground-based observations that measure small angular scales in particular. And so I'm going to focus on things that we expect from Simons Observatory, CMBS4, and CMBHD, with a slight bias towards CMBS4, because that's where I spend a lot of my effort. Great. Okay. So that was a lightning review of the CMB. Any questions before I move on?
So the gray ones are not funded, is that the thing?
So these light shaded ones are not funded. CMBS4 technically is not funded, but it's been strongly endorsed by Astro 2020 and P5, so it's in the pipeline on these org charts.
What about Lightbird?
Oh, Lightbird is funded, so it's space-based. So these are balloon experiments. This is a space-based experiment. And then these kind of lighter things with the dotted borders are planned or proposed, but not planned. There's no launch date for Pixie or Pico, no build date for CMBHD. Sure. All right, great. So as I said, we will do more of the same of what I just described, measuring the power spectrum, placing tighter constraints on parameters that define lambda CDM and physics beyond it. But there are new challenges that will arise as the precision of the data improves with these next generation experiments. And so to give one characteristic example of the ways in which there are new challenges but also new opportunities, I'm going to next describe gravitational lensing of the cosmic microwave background. Gravitational lensing of the CMB refers to the deflection of CMB photons by variations in the gravitational potential along the line of sight between us and the surface of last scattering. The effects of gravitational lensing on the CMB are most easily seen with an example. So this is a simulated patch of 5 degrees by 5 degrees with the unlensed E-mode polarization on the left, unlensed B-mode polarization on the right, and I'm going to lens these maps with a potential that is shown there at the bottom. So if I go from the unlensed CMB sky to the lensed CMB sky, the most obvious change is that the lensed B modes are not zero. We started in this case with zero B modes for the unlensed case. And so the most obvious thing is that the lensed B modes are no longer vanishing. And this is due to the fact that the deflection of CMB photons has converted the E mode polarization pattern into the B mode polarization pattern. But there are also more subtle changes. If you look at the E mode as I flip back and forth, you can see that various patches of the E-mode sky are magnified and demagnified. And so those points are shifted around. And if you look very closely, you can also convince yourself that the lensed B-modes that you get from lensing are correlated with the E-modes that you started with. And those correlations, the correlations between the lensed modes observed in various patches and between the lensed E and lensed B-modes, allow us to infer the presence of this lensing deflection. And we can use that correlation to reconstruct a map of the CMB lensing. This has been done, and it has been done quite well by Planck to make a 40 sigma observation of the effects of lensing in the CMB. And so this is that map, the reconstructed lensing map. And one really cool thing about this is that this lensing is caused by the structure that intervenes between us and the surface of last scattering. And so this is really a map of the integrated line of sight density of all of the matter in the universe between us and the surface of last scattering. And because that matter is dominated by dark matter, this is in effect a map of the integrated line of sight dark matter throughout the universe. Now, this is an observation that we've already achieved at 40 sigma. And even at this stage, lensing acts as both a blessing and a curse. So in particular, CMB lensing allows us access to information about the content of the matter that intervenes between us and the surface of last scattering. So even by measuring just a single screen at recombination, we're getting information about all the structure that intervenes between us and that high redshift. On the other hand, this lensing deflection distorts our view of the primary CMB. And for parameters which are best measured with a pristine snapshot of the early universe, this is a source of contamination. So the most well-known example of this is if we're searching for primordial gravitational waves through primordial B-mode polarization, we just showed that lensing generates B-mode polarization even in the absence of primordial gravitational waves, and those act as a source of confusion when we're looking for primordial gravitational waves with B-mode polarization. Okay. Now, this dual role of lensing as both a blessing and a curse will be dramatically enhanced in our upcoming observations because the precision with which we measure the effects of CMB lensing will also dramatically improve. So one way of demonstrating this numerically is to ask about the power spectrum of the CMB lensing map. So the idea is the same here. You take a map of the reconstructed lensing, you compute its two-point correlation function and its harmonic transform. That gives you the angular power spectrum of lensing shown in black. And then you can compare that to the uncertainty in our reconstruction, which are shown in those colored lines. So the current noise from Planck is in this yellow line here. And so you can see that actually for most of the modes that I showed you in this map, we're dominated by noise and not by signal. So actually this is mostly a map of noise, but it does contain information about the content of dark matter throughout the universe. But with future observations, something that's kind of on the order of CMBS4, we will bring down this noise very significantly, and we will image all of the modes of CMB lensing out to about L of 1,000. Okay, so we will have a very high fidelity map of the CMB lensing throughout the universe with future observations. Okay, so CMB lensing will be a very prominent feature of upcoming CMB observations. And the next thing I'm going to tell you is, why should we care? Why should we hope to measure the CMB lensing? And the example I'm going to use is measurement of cosmic neutrinos. Sorry, did you have a question?
Can I ask you to rewind?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like a totally trivial, simple question, but the black is the lensing power spectrum?
That's the lensing power spectrum, yeah. That's right.
And that's telling you about like where the lensing is coming from, like the kernel basically.
Yeah, that's right. So that's a big part of it. So in particular, the lenses are closer to us than the CMB, and so the angular scale is right. So this lensing power spectrum is, roughly speaking, the matter power spectrum, which has a very similar shape, projected onto the lensing kernel. So lenses at different redshifts contribute to the lensing power spectrum at different scales. And so when you do that integral, this is what you get. And so you can see that the shape mirrors like the P of K, the matter power spectrum. But you're right, it's much closer to us. And so the peak of this is set by the distance to those lenses and also where the peak of the matter power spectrum is.
Okay. What kind of implications does that have? Because if you're going up to L of 1,000, it looks like you're getting more modes, but looks like your signal is dropping off a lot. Is there still a lot there?
Oh yeah, great question. Yeah, so roughly speaking, as you go from larger modes to smaller modes, you're measuring horizon scale type structures down to cluster scale type things as you get to smaller and smaller scales. And so there's value in having information across that whole range of scales. So I'll give you one example of why we want to measure small scale lenses with the cosmic neutrinos. There's also astrophysical interest in having measurements of these things across a wide range of scales. For example, these lensing maps are very useful in cross-correlation. So you expect you're mapping the matter throughout the universe, so you can look for galaxy overdensities in the regions that the lensing is high, for example. Roughly speaking, you get more cosmological fluctuations, more independent modes by measuring more and more modes of the CMB lensing power spectrum. But there are also characteristic signatures that we expect to show up on small scales. And the cosmic neutrinos will be one example of that.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, sure. Other questions at this point? Okay. Okay, great. Right, so hopefully I've motivated to you that CMB lensing will play this dual role. And now I'll get more specific and say why it is that we want to measure the CMB lensing with the example of cosmic neutrinos. It is known that standard model neutrinos have mass, non-zero mass. We measure very precisely the mass squared splittings from flavor oscillation experiments. But what we don't measure from terrestrial experiments is what is the overall mass scale of neutrinos. And we also don't measure the ordering of the masses. So these two options, the normal ordering or the inverted ordering, which has to do with the sign of one of the mass squared splittings. Now, we have upper limits on the overall mass scale, but making that measurement in a lab is really, really difficult because the mass scale, the mass squared splittings are so small, which implies a low overall scale, overall scale for these masses. And you're typically doing lab measurements that involve beta decays or nuclear interactions with a typical scale of hundreds of keV or MeV, and the effects of neutrino mass tend to be suppressed by the mass scale of the neutrinos divided by the mass scale or the energy scale relevant for the experiment to some power. And so we're talking about MeV scale masses for the absolute mass scale of neutrinos compared, milli-electron volt scale for the absolute mass scale of neutrinos compared to mega-electron volt for the typical terrestrial experiment. However, cosmology offers us an opportunity to measure the absolute mass scale of neutrinos because the gravitational influence of the cosmic neutrino background has observational impacts on cosmology. And so that's what I'll describe to you next. So the starting point for this is that there exists a cosmic neutrino background that's a generic prediction of hot Big Bang cosmology, much like the cosmic microwave background was produced when the photons stopped interacting with the plasma, in that case due to the plasma forming a neutral gas. Cosmic neutrinos were previously in thermal equilibrium with that plasma due to weak interactions in the early universe. But as the expansion of the universe made those weak interactions less efficient, at some point the weak interaction rate dropped below the expansion rate and the neutrinos decoupled from the thermal plasma. Now, when this occurred, the neutrinos didn't simply disappear. They began a free expansion. And thereafter, electrons and positrons annihilated and heated photons relative to the neutrinos. So the neutrino background was diluted relative to photons, but it didn't go away. We expect and we predict a nearly thermal spectrum of cosmic neutrinos with a temperature that we can calculate as being related to the cosmic microwave background temperature by just simple counting of the degrees of freedom and conservation of entropy in the early universe. And so that's where this factor of 4/11 to the 1/3 comes from, is just counting the degrees of freedom and the fact that the entropy from the electrons and positrons were transferred to the photons and not to the neutrinos. And what that implies is that the cosmic neutrino background today has a temperature a little below 2 Kelvin, or an energy scale of about 10 to the minus 4 electron volts. And given those mass squared splittings from oscillation experiments, this implies that at least two mass eigenstates of neutrinos are non-relativistic today. And what that means is that cosmology provides us with a very large abundance of non-relativistic neutrinos. And this is a very unique opportunity because, as I mentioned, typical lab-based experiments will generate very ultra-relativistic neutrinos given the energy scale at which those experiments take place compared to the masses. So cosmology gives us this opportunity of a huge wealth of non-relativistic neutrinos. And those non-relativistic neutrinos have gravitational imprints on the formation of structure that allow us to access this neutrino mass through cosmological observations. In particular, non-relativistic neutrinos contribute like non-relativistic matter to the total energy density today. However, they acted like radiation in the early universe. They were ultra-relativistic in the early universe. They're non-relativistic today. And so even though they contribute to the expansion rate as non-relativistic matter at present, they don't cluster like cold dark matter. Instead, they act like hot dark matter. The large thermal velocities cause the neutrinos to free stream out of potential wells. And so neutrinos contribute to the matter density in terms of expansion, but don't contribute that way in terms of the clustering. And so as a result, what you predict in a model that contains massive neutrinos is that you get a suppression of the clustering of matter as compared to a model which has only massless neutrinos, but the same overall matter density. And so that's what's being shown here. This is the matter power spectrum, or the ratio of the matter power spectrum in a model that has massive neutrinos shown at different redshifts compared to one in which there are only massless neutrinos. And so there's a suppression of power, suppression of matter clustering on scales below the free streaming length of neutrinos due to the fact that the neutrinos free stream out of potential wells. So this suppression of clustering is the key observable of the presence of massive neutrinos in cosmology. Now, there are various means by which we can hope to access this suppression of power, but I'll say in advance what we're looking for is this suppression as compared to what you would have had in the absence of this suppression. And so what you need to do is compare to the clustering of matter or the amplitude of fluctuations on large scales at early times that doesn't have this suppression. Okay. Now there are several probes of the matter power spectrum which we can hope to use to infer the presence of this suppression. And what's being shown here is various probes shown in different colors. So there's CMB lensing in this blue, galaxy densities in the yellow, and then galaxy cluster counts in red. And what's being shown is where you have sensitivity from these various probes in the plane of redshift and wave number. So these are larger scales on the left, smaller scales on the right, and then at present today, and then higher redshift as you go up. This purple line shows the free streaming scale. So that shows where this transition between the unsuppressed and suppressed fluctuations occur. And so to observe this suppression, what we need to have is measurement of the matter power spectrum to the right of this line. There's another line that's relevant though, which is this red dash dot line here, which shows the a rough deviation between linear fluctuations and nonlinear fluctuations. So to the right of this line is where you expect nonlinear gravitational effects to become important in the amplitude of clustering of matter. And so a key idea, a key takeaway here is that CMB lensing allows us access to many modes, many fluctuation modes of the matter power spectrum in the regime that should see suppression from massive neutrinos, but still in the linear regime. Okay, so CMB lensing is a very useful probe of neutrino mass because it doesn't have a lot of the modeling uncertainties that come from nonlinearities. But it is sufficiently in the regime where neutrinos are leading to this suppression. Okay.
Wait, what are these other shaded regions?
How do you get to this? What is that? So the colored peaks, so there's this is like a mountain plot, so like peaks at every redshift. So it's showing the signal to noise weighted measurement of the power spectrum from these various probes. So for example, from galaxy cluster counts, what you can infer about the matter power spectrum is the matter power spectrum at these wave numbers, at this redshift, and then it goes to higher wave numbers as you go to higher redshifts when you're measuring cluster counts. Right. Signal to noise per mode, and then to be a little bit more specific, so CMB lensing is done with CMBS4, galaxy density is done with LSST, cluster counts come from cluster counts anticipated from CMBS4 TSC measurements. You also, to get the redshift information, you also have to have an optical survey or some other survey to give you redshift information from the TSC detected clusters. All right, and so CMB lensing provides us a measurement of the integrated matter density, integrated along the line of sight. And so we can take a map of our reconstructed lensing potential throughout the universe, calculate its angular power spectrum. And now what I'm showing is the suppression due to massive neutrinos, but now in the space of the lensing power spectrum instead of the matter power spectrum. So one thing to notice, this is the fractional change due to neutrinos. So one thing to notice is that for CMB lensing, the suppression is almost scale invariant, which is a little bit unfortunate because what it means is that we're measuring basically a single number from CMB lensing with regard to this suppression of clustering. Had this transition occurred at a higher L, smaller angular scale, you could use just CMB observations to say that we see this suppression, and then you could measure the offset, the amount of suppression coming from CMB lensing. Here, instead, what we actually get is basically just a measurement of this one number. Now, we measure that number very well from CMB lensing. If you looked at this plot, you might say, oh, we'll have a booming measurement of the effects of CMB, of neutrino mass. And in fact, we measure this amplitude very well, but it's only useful with regard to a measurement of neutrino mass if we can calibrate what this would have been in the absence of neutrino mass. So we need to know where is this dotted line, but this is not what we measure. We measure this solid line. And that unfortunately is subject to a few degeneracies. which I won't go into unless people have questions, but the biggest of those degeneracies is the measurement of the optical depth to reionization, which limits our ability to measure the primordial amplitude from the CMB, amplitude. Despite all of that, with current measurements of that optical depth, CMBS4 will enable a measurement of the neutrino mass with an uncertainty of about 24 millielectron volts. That should be compared with the minimal possible sum of neutrino masses in the normal ordering case, which is about 60 millielectron volts. And with a future CMB satellite, like for example, Lightbird, we'll achieve a cosmic variance limited measurement of tau, which will improve our measurement to about 14 millielectron volts with CMB lensing. And that's about a 4 sigma detection of even the minimal mass of neutrinos.
So what's that lambda CDM?
This is lambda CDM plus neutrino mass and plus N effective, but that's just a legacy from how I did the calculation. And then also I should say that BAO, DESI BAO, is included in this measurement to fix the matter density, which is the other important degeneracy that's relevant here.
Did you like marginalize over the dark energy
parameters? How does this change? Yeah, so it worsens by about a factor of 2 if you marginalize over W naught and WA. You can mitigate that weakening of the constraint if you include something that has redshift information. So for example, cluster counts. Using like TSC detected clusters, if you think you can calibrate the clusters, would improve this. The galaxy power spectrum from DESI claims a similar error bar to both of these without using CMB lensing. And so multiple probes, I think, will be useful for this because of exactly the type of thing you're talking about.
Can I ask you one more question? So first of all, is this sensitive to normal algebraic hierarchy?
No, good question. This is not sensitive to that because this gets a little bit into the weeds, but this suppression, you might actually, strictly speaking, predict a slightly different suppression because there's a redshift dependent factor in this suppression. And in the normal and inverted hierarchy, the cosmic time at which a given eigenstate becomes non-relativistic differs. But that effect is really tiny because both of them happen very early. One way to phrase it is it would bias this measurement at a sub millielectron volt, and I think
The other thing is, let's say you detect something.
Yes.
With something fading, and I'm talking about standard model, not DSM field, I'm talking about standard model, I'm asking about programs, you mentioned optical bed.
Yes.
So what other possible things would be there. Let's say, because I mean, it looks like you may be able to measure the atmosphere of the film very soon.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's say delta make it positive, would you be sure that it comes from the film?
Yeah, I think the biggest uncertainty and the biggest worry that I personally have does come down to this optical depth, because the way we measure the optical depth is very subject to astrophysical foregrounds. Specifically, the way we measure the optical depth relies on large angular scale measurements of the E-mode polarization. That's best done from space, because if you try to do it from the ground, you're comparing lines of sight that are very different across the sky, so you're looking through different amounts of atmosphere. So we effectively have to rely on measurements from space or from balloons. So there are a few balloon proposals that are going after tau. I should also say there's an observational proposal for the CLASS experiment, which hopes to do this from the ground, but they'll face challenges. The other big challenge when you're looking across large fractions of sky is that the galactic foregrounds change dramatically from one region of the sky to the other, but you care a lot about these largest scales. So I can very quickly jump all the way back here just to make this a little bit more specific. So the measurement of tau comes from this bump right here, okay? And you'll notice this L is 10. From the ground, we only expect to rely on our measurements down to about L of 30. So effectively, ground-based measurements are blind to this bump. But we want to measure this bump. You can measure it from space because the atmosphere is not an issue, but you do have to worry about galactic foregrounds. But then you're still limited to very few modes. And so even a little bit of contamination in those very few modes can cause this thing to change a decent amount. So that's my biggest concern with regard to this measurement, is the measurement of tau. the lensing is relatively robust. One thing that's kind of implicit in this plot that I'm not explaining so explicitly is that you actually do not rely on the measurement of CMB lensing way up here. You can cut all of this and you do not change, you don't move this error bar at all. So, and that's kind of what's being demonstrated here. So you might worry about nonlinear effects or similarly baryonic effects in your interpretation of what you measure from the CMB lensing power spectrum. Both of those become important at small scales. But for the purpose of inferring this, you can cut here. You can say, okay, I don't trust anything up there, and it doesn't really change this. And that's just due to the fact that all we're measuring is this one number, this suppression. And you do that already with these first few bins. Sure. All right, other questions at this point? Okay, great.
So in the galaxy two-point function, right? Yeah, and so if you wanted to measure the human mass of, so using galaxy two-point question, there are some internal consistency tests we can do. Mm-hmm. So you can look at the 8F mu effect and also the 1F mu effect to get high signals and noise.
Right.
So here's an even analysis of that?
Only in cross-correlation, I think, is the quick statement. Right, you're roughly referring to the fact that this changes over the suppression changes over redshift. And so if you are able to cross-correlate your CMB lensing measurement with a galaxy survey, you should similarly see an evolution of the suppression. That's not CMB lensing on its own, but it's a way, the cross-correlation does mitigate some errors, some systematics and things like that. But I think you're right. I think, yeah. Both your question about dark energy and about potential biases would benefit from redshift information which CMB lensing does not provide. Good. Okay. All right, so there was something kind of that I didn't make clear, which is why you might care about the neutrino mass measurement. So if you're a particle physicist, probably it's not so, I don't have to motivate this to you so strongly. But if you're a cosmologist, you might ask, why do we care? What's the point? And in fact, to go a step further, we already roughly know the absolute mass scale of neutrinos because we know the minimum from the absolute from the mass squared splittings. And there's an upper limit that's about 120 millielectron volts from current observations. So you might say that's good enough. We have this thing bracketed within a small region. But I'd like to argue that there is, in fact, a reason to care, whether you care about particle physics, cosmology, or astrophysics. So for particle physics, the absolute mass scale measurement is important for setting targets for lab-based measurements of the neutrino mass or its effects. So for example, one of the big observational efforts in the US is measurement of neutrinoless double beta decay. And cosmology provides constraints on the absolute mass scale, which is a different combination of the neutrino mass eigenstates than is probed by neutrinoless double beta decay. And a detection from cosmology would allow for a target with regard to the neutrinoless double beta decay experiments. In particular, if you are pushed all the way down to the minimum mass scale, then you would expect that next generation experiments should not see anything from standard model neutrinos. However, that would help if there was a detection from a neutrinoless double beta decay experiment, that would then point toward new physics, for example. In cosmology, there's also a reason to care about this neutrino mass, which doesn't necessarily have anything to do with neutrinos, but measuring the suppression that comes from massive cosmological neutrinos is really a very thorough end-to-end test of cosmology. What I relied on to give this argument about how we measure neutrino masses relies on the whole evolution of the cosmological model from decoupling of neutrinos at 1 megaelectron volt all the way down through structure formation at low redshift. And there's a lot that can go wrong in that measurement, including, for example, the presence of other light fields or light but massive fields. Decay of cosmological neutrinos would also mess up this measurement, or a change to the expansion history would also change what I've said here. And so measuring the suppression due to massive neutrinos is really a thorough end-to-end test of cosmology. Furthermore, because we have several probes of neutrino mass, cosmic CMB lensing, galaxy density, clusters, et cetera, all of those things are measuring the suppression, but they're subject to different systematics and different baryonic and astrophysical effects. And so if we can pin down the absolute mass scale of neutrinos, that can help us disentangle some of these other astrophysical or baryonic feedback effects in these other probes when we combine the probes. Okay. So there is reason to be excited about this neutrino mass measurement, even if you don't necessarily care about neutrinos. Okay, and so hopefully I've motivated to you that there is value in making measurement of the CMB lensing. And so in the next few minutes here, I'm just going to discuss one way that we might hope to improve our measurement of CMB lensing. So far our observations have been restricted to a regime where lensing is a relatively small, a subtle change to what we observe in CMB fluctuations. However, with future observations, we're going to push towards smaller angular scales where lensing, the lensing-induced fluctuations actually will become the dominant contribution to the lensing power spectrum. So if I zoom in on these small scales, you can see that the lensed power spectrum dominates over exceeds the unlensed power spectrum. And so this different regime might motivate some different ways of thinking about ways that we go after measurements of the lensing power spectrum. And so one simple thing you can do is just to say, well, this lensing, the amplitude of the power spectrum on small angular scales allows me to read off the amplitude of the lensing effect. And you can do that from the power spectrum, and that works pretty well. But you can actually go further, because not only is this an enhancement in power, but these modes must be non-Gaussian. So lensing transfers power from large scales to small scales due to the presence of these small scale lenses, but it does so in such a way that's correlated with the large scale gradients. And so we can utilize that fact to try to do better than just reading off the lensing amplitude from the power spectrum. And so this is just demonstrating that if you simulate a map of the CMB sky and you cut your CMB into little patches, the regions that have a larger large scale gradient in that patch also exhibit more small scale power due to the lensing. So this is just to say that the small scale lensing power is correlated with the large scale gradient power in the CMB. And so you can make this a little bit more concrete. So you can filter your CMB temperature on large scale gradient power and small scale gradient power. And then you can see already by eye, so this is the unlensed CMB. So there's very little power on small scales in the unlensed CMB, but there's a lot of power on small scales in the lens CMB. And you can see by eye that these fields are correlated, the squared CMB large scale temperature, the squared CMB small scale temperature. And this motivates an estimator where you can construct these maps and filter on different angular scales. And this makes it even more clear that you can see that there's correlation across a range of scales. Okay. And so we constructed this estimator that we call small correlated against large estimator, where you take your CMB map, you take gradients and filter on large scales and small scales, you take the power, you square the maps, that gives you two maps, one on large scales, one on small scales, and then you can cross-correlate these things. And the amplitude of this resulting quantity gives you a measurement of the CMB lensing power spectrum on small scales. And what's being shown here is that when you go to higher precision measurements, like with CMBS4, you can actually exceed the precision with which you can measure the CMB's power spectrum compared to the standard techniques like the quadratic estimator. It looks like you have a question, Kendrick. Okay, good. So there's value to measuring the CMB lensing, and hopefully there are ways to improve it beyond current techniques. The next thing I'm going to discuss is why lensing acts as a curse, and I'm going to focus on the measurement of light relics for that. So light relics refer to any contributions to the energy density that act like radiation in particular the early universe. Cosmic neutrinos provide one example within the standard model of light relics that are predicted in standard hot Big Bang cosmology. And so the basic idea here is that as we discussed earlier, the cosmic neutrinos decoupled at a temperature of about 1 mega electron volt. To be a little bit more specific about the way that this decoupling goes, the decoupling is not instantaneous or nearly instantaneous like it is in the case of the CMB, but rather it's energy dependent. And so this is what I'm plotting here is like the visibility function, the peak visibility function of the cosmic neutrino background. And you can see that it has this energy dependence. So not all the neutrinos decouple at the same time. And so factoring in those little effects, you can make a prediction for the energy density in cosmic neutrinos in the standard model. And what you predict is phrased often in terms of this number n effective, which is the effective number of neutrino species. It's defined such that in the limit of instantaneous decoupling, this would just count the number of families of neutrinos. But because of these non-instantaneous decoupling effects, you predict a number that's slightly larger than the three families that we expect in the standard model. So you predict 3.044. So the target of measuring light relics is measuring this number and effective. Let me just take one quick diversion to say that cosmic neutrinos play a special role with regard to their contribution to the radiation energy density, in that neutrinos play a role through their weak interactions in the process of Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So they are responsible for interconverting protons and neutrons, and thus feed into the calculation of primordial abundances. And this becomes a really interesting thing to study, especially when you combine primordial element abundances with measurements of the CMB to simultaneously constrain things like the light relic density, the primordial helium abundance, and then you can get some insights into the cosmic neutrino background beyond just their overall energy density. However, it's worth saying that there are many extensions of the standard model which predict additional light degrees of freedom beyond neutrinos, and all of those sources of light degrees of freedom would contribute to our measurement of N effective. Anything that acts like radiation apart from photons will contribute to our measurement of N effective. So this includes very well-motivated extensions of the standard model, like axions and axion-like particles, complex dark sectors, or sterile neutrinos. Some of these may play a role in understanding the nature of dark matter, for example. And there are many more examples. Gravitational waves, for example, act to contribute to the gravitational radiation density. And so our measurement of N effective is naturally a very broad constraint on all of this new physics. But to go a step further, this is not just a blind fishing expedition. We actually have really concrete targets to go after in our measurement of N effective. And this comes from thinking about light thermal relics. So cosmic neutrinos provide an example of a light thermal relic within the standard model. They were in thermal equilibrium at early times. They decoupled and didn't just go away, but they were diluted based on the annihilation of, in that case, electrons and positrons. And the same thing would be true if we had new light degrees of freedom that had been in thermal contact with the standard model. When they decouple, they don't just go away, but they do get diluted due to the annihilation of the other stuff in the standard model. Now, because we know the particle content of the standard model, if we know the decoupling temperature of any new light degree of freedom, we can make a prediction of its contribution to the energy density today because we know how much it would have gotten diluted compared to photons. As a result, we can make this plot, which tells us our prediction for the change to N effective expected from a new light degree of freedom given its decoupling temperature. And now the really interesting thing about upcoming CMB experiments is that this number will improve such that we push to much, much higher decoupling temperatures and therefore much, much weaker couplings of potentially new light degrees of freedom that may exist in our universe. And so this thermal relic plot provides clear targets to go after. And in particular, CMBS4 will achieve a measurement such that we can go beyond the QCD phase transition and push to much orders of magnitude higher energy scale in terms of the decoupling of new light degrees of freedom. Okay, and so how do we actually measure this thing, this quantity? With the CMB, the change to the radiation energy density affects the expansion rate around the time of recombination and thereby changes the amount of time that photons have to free stream during the epoch of recombination and therefore changes the length scale over which nearby regions would have become equilibrated, and therefore you change the amount of diffusion damping that the CMB experiences. In particular, when you change N effective, you change the damping scale observed in the CMB power spectrum. This is the most prominent effect of changes to N effective, and this has the most constraining power with regard to measuring the light relic density. And because this diffusion damping results in an exponential suppression of the power spectrum, you're best off measuring very wide regions of sky to measure as many modes as you can in the universe. You might imagine a different strategy would be to measure very small angular scales by going very deep in one patch of sky. But if you do that, you're fighting against an exponential fall off of the signal, whereas observing time or detector time decreases your noise linearly. And so you're better off measuring many new modes by going as wide as possible on the sky. And so with CMBS4, we designed the survey to have as wide of survey coverage as possible in order to maximize our ability to measure light relic density. Okay. All right, so you might ask, what does this have to do with lensing? I motivated this by saying that lensing can act as a hindrance to our measurement of light relics. So now let me bring lensing into the picture. And to do so, I need to talk about one other observational impact of changes to the light relic density in terms of the CMB. So not only do we measure the background energy density of light degrees of freedom, we also measure the gravitational influences of their fluctuations. In particular, cosmic neutrinos, for example, have fluctuations in their density that are inherited from the fact that the density fluctuations affected the whole plasma at early times. Similar things should apply for other light relics. And cosmic neutrinos, after they decouple, free stream. And so the sound speed of the fluctuations in the neutrino density propagate at the speed of light and not at the sound speed of the plasma. And what that means is that fluctuations in the neutrino density go out past the wavefront of the sound speed in the plasma and thereby drag that fluctuation to larger physical scales. And this results in a phase shift, a characteristic phase shift of the acoustic peaks in the CMB. So what's being shown here is the effect of changes to ineffective. So this is the same plot in weird units that I showed previously. And then if you fix the damping scale, what you can see is that there is a phase shift. These peaks shift, and then this is just zooming in to show you that as you change ineffective, the peak and trough positions shift to the left and the right. And that's due to the fact that free streaming light degrees of freedom have a sound speed that exceeds the sound speed of the plasma in the early universe. This characteristic phase shift allows us to distinguish between free streaming radiation and self-interacting or fluid-like radiation that might be contributing to the radiation density of the universe. And so this phase shift is already measured in current data and will be much better measured with future data. This is just showing that you can distinguish between fluid-like and free streaming radiation, and you can also help you distinguish between the effects of primordial helium, which also changes the damping scale and changes to the light relic density and effective. Okay, so what does this have to do with lensing? Well, one of the effects of CMB lensing is to smooth out acoustic peaks in the CMB power spectrum. So this is showing a dramatically increased effect of CMB lensing. This A lens just parameterizes the amplitude of CMB lensing. As you go from no lensing in the black to increased lensing in the lighter colors, you see that you smooth out these acoustic peaks. You can understand this physically just by the fact that various regions of sky will be magnified or demagnified. So if you had something at a characteristic angular scale, that characteristic angular scale will be spread to some larger angular scales and smaller angular scales in different regions of sky. And therefore, sharp features in the power spectrum get spread out. Okay. So CMB lensing induces this peak smoothing, and delensing inverts this effect. So if you can reconstruct the CMB lensing field and invert its effects, you can actually sharpen the peaks of the observed CMB power spectrum. And so along with Salim and others, we developed code to do this, to self-consistently model how well you can delens. And you can see from this plot that you recover sharper peaks after delensing with upcoming surveys. And this is valuable because sharper peaks are easier to localize. So if you have a sharper feature in a CMB power spectrum, you can better determine the scale at which that peak occurs. And so what's being shown here is that for the TE power spectrum, delensing lowers your error bar on the peak position and the peak height. And those peak positions and peak heights are proxies for how well we can measure certain effects, certain parameters that determine the shape of the CMB power spectrum. Now in particular, oh, sorry, yes.
So this idea of delensing, I guess, goes back to Hirata and Solzhak or even earlier. So how is your method different from theirs?
Yeah, good. So their method uses a maximum likelihood estimator to reconstruct simultaneously a delensed CMB and then a lensing map. Their technique would be a way by which you could achieve the thing that we're talking about here, which is you can delens. So I should say this work did not involve a map-based procedure for delensing. It was more focused on predicting the power spectrum that you would get out of applying such a process to real data and why it's valuable. So right, and so after you do this procedure, you can better localize these peaks, and that in turn leads to tighter constraints on parameters. And in particular, it leads to tighter constraints on the light relic density because that phase shift due to the free streaming nature of new light degrees of freedom shifts the peak positions. If you can better measure peak positions, you can better measure the free streaming radiation density. It's also valuable for other applications, like, for example, if you care about the Hubble tension, the effect, the way that we measure the Hubble constant from CMB data is strongly related to the way that we can localize peaks, because that is closely associated with the angular diameter distance to the surface of last scattering. So models that shift our inference of H-naught from the CMB often end up shifting peaks. And so delensing allows for tighter constraints on peak positions and therefore tighter constraints on extensions of the standard model of cosmology aimed at resolving the Hubble tension. We can also better constrain models of early universe physics that lead to the generation of the initial spectrum of density fluctuations. So this is also work with Salim, showing that you can get improved constraints on the primordial power spectrum P of K by delensing. Additionally, in this work, we showed that you can better constrain primordial features, spatial curvature, isocurvature fluctuations, et cetera. So delensing has really broad benefits across a really wide range of topics. And the basic idea is that if you can better localize peaks and remove some of the effects of lensing, you have you can improve your inference of cosmological parameters. Okay, I have just a couple minutes left. I probably don't have time for this. Let me just very quickly summarize by saying that
Can I ask about delensing?
Oh, yes, please.
Could you also understand our polarization and if we get rid of the
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, I should, that, thank you. I should have said that delensing has been understood to be valuable to get rid of B-modes for a long time. That's been the application of delensing that has been most widely appreciated. And indeed, so if you measure the CMB lenses and you invert the effect of lensing, you remove the lensing CMB, sorry, the lensed B modes that act as a contaminant for the search for primordial gravitational waves. And that process will be necessary to achieve the targets of upcoming surveys. The target for, say, CMBS4 is 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4 for an upper, 5 times 10 to the minus 4 for an upper limit, and 10 to the minus 3 on R, the tensor to scalar ratio. And that requires, it requires about 90% efficiency in the delensing. The number I was quoting was on the tensor to scalar ratio, which shifts the amplitude of the signal. Sorry, just to make this slightly more clear. So what we're talking about is this solid black line is the lensed B modes. This is the prediction of a model with the tensor to scalar ratio of 10 to the minus 2. We want to measure this an order of magnitude better. And so we need to lower the amplitude of the B mode, the lensed B mode power spectrum by an order of magnitude as well. Yeah. Yeah, had nature been kind, we wouldn't have needed to do this because this would exceed the lensed B modes. But we've gotten to a point where we need to do this for future experiments. Okay, so I'll just breeze through the last bit just by saying that CMB lensing is not the only source of imprints of structure intervening between us and the surface of last scattering. And as soon as you introduce additional effects of additional sources of statistical anisotropy, the analysis to separate these things becomes a little bit complicated. And so one might turn to a tool like machine learning, which is useful for analyzing nonlinear physics. And we demonstrated along with my grad student that you can in fact do this very successfully to disentangle patchy reionization and CMB lensing, cosmic polarization and CMB lensing, and then you can also recover primordial B modes with the machine learning network in the way that you'd expect from other tools. Okay, so let me just conclude by saying that the next generation of CMB surveys will provide many new opportunities across particle physics, cosmology, and astrophysics. Achieving all of that requires that we tackle these new challenges associated with the higher precision in the data, but we have methods and approaches to do that, and so it should be an exciting decade to come for CMB science. Thanks very much.
A little bit of lunch after this, so there'll be like more opportunity to chat with Joel, but we have a few questions for him. Questions for Joel. curious, I guess I'll ask a question about the part of the plastic skip.
Yeah.
I was sort of curious. It sounds like you were swapping out a few different quadratic estimators for a
robot. Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. I was sort of wondering, a really well-sorted way of disentangling those signals would be to like a 3x3 matrix that would measure the coupling between the different quadratic estimators and then invert that matrix to separate.
Yeah.
Is that something that you've got? But that wouldn't capture higher order things like iterative.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, exactly. So right. So what Kendrick is saying here is that so if you try to reconstruct by standard techniques simultaneously patchy reionization and gravitational lensing, the estimators are not totally disjoint, and so you expect a bias for your patchy reionization reconstruction in the presence of CMB lensing. That's what's being shown here. It's really hard to parse this plot quickly, but the very light blue dashed line shows the bias to the quadratic estimator for the patchy tau reconstruction in the presence of lensing. Now, there's a relatively standard technique by which you can circumvent this bias, which is often known as bias hardening. So you can set up estimators. You can construct an estimator for the patchy tau that explicitly nulls the contribution that would come from CMB lensing, in which case you recover the signal that you would anticipate in the absence of this bias. So that's kind of what you would do with like the Simons Observatory, for example, to do the best that you can possibly do. However, if you go to the next generation of CMB experiments like CMBS4, that fails to account for the fact that there are improvements that you can make to lensing that go beyond the quadratic estimator that require like iterative delensing. And so our argument for why you might pursue a neural network type solution to that is that analysis, when you try to do like iterated bias hardened reconstruction, is that the reconstruction noise becomes really nonlinear and really complicated. In principle, you can work it all out. And our goal was really to show that the neural network kind of skips all of that and does it in one step and achieves what you'd anticipate from, so this, I didn't show it here. We have another plot where we show like what you would get from an idealized iterated procedure, and you can show that you match that.
That's a really good
one. Yeah, thanks. And yeah, right, so the same thing is true in this case, there's no bias because the cosmic polarization rotation estimator is not biased by the lensing, but you can show that you can do all three simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks, Joel Gunter.